because it did turn out a lot of manpower for the pulpit, and a lot of these went west. So even though these revivals did not last, in these colleges, there was enough revival, and there was enough of them, that did produce some notable leaders for the ministry who were very spiritual men. There were 15 periods of revival at Yale. We need one now. In writing of a revival in 1802, a participant recorded, "Worst ever students are found in their rooms, in the chapel, in the hall, in the college yard, in their walks about the city. The radiant impression was, surely God is in this place. The salvation of the soul is the great subject of conversation and absorbing interest." Jedediah Morris tried to battle Unitarianism at Harvard. He couldn't, so he started a new school called Andover, still in existence. He fought any innovation in theology, any departure from Edwardian theology. The hill upon which it sat came to be called Brimstone Hill. One day, the headmaster of this academy addressed the class with this remark. After class was over, "There will now be a prayer meeting. Those who wish to lie down everlasting burning may go. The rest will stay." If you want to go to hell, you can leave, but those who don't want to go to hell will stay for the prayer meeting. A couple of boys left with their hearty souls. But that's pretty extreme, but there was revival. In the West, Oberlin College in Ohio and Knox College in Illinois were founded by men from New England, as I said. Missionary and Bible track societies were formed. There was a great deal of genuine interest. Now, one historian wrote, "The whole voluntary society apparatus launched a great saturation campaign to save the Mississippi Valley and thus save the nation." What happened was, from the East, where there was more education, came men who were better trained and who were revived, and they produced literature. You see, literature was very expensive, and they began to produce tracts and Bibles for the frontier. And they were sort of, it was a missionary enterprise. It was a missionary enterprise. And so this is what created the Bible Belt. Have you heard of the Bible Belt? This was it. So what happened was, to summarize, it started really with McGready in Logan County, and it started in the frontier, Kentucky mainly, the Second Great Awakening, early part of the 1800s. It spread back to the East, mainly in the colleges. But from these colleges, men went to the pulpits of the East and the West and started some colleges and printed Bibles. And so it kind of fed back into the frontier from the East. This helped sustain the revival. On page 145, I have this summary statement of religion on the frontier. This is very important. Revival and the frontier sing this together. Revival on the frontier was sparked both locally and from the East. I've said that. The isolation of the frontier made settlers eager to participate in any kind of community life. So the church became a social center in a way that it's hard for us to understand sometimes. The Presbyterians were in a good position. Why? Well, they were dug in. But they did not do as well. The Presbyterians did well in the more settled areas. They didn't do as well on the frontier because they were a little too sophisticated. The Baptist groups did well on the frontier because their worship was very simple, their doctrine was very simple, and they used lay preachers. That is, the Baptist churches would use untrained preachers in a way the Presbyterian churches would not. The farmer who farms all week and preaches on the weekend has always been, listen to me, this idea of the lay preachers, they call it, the comparatively untrained man who's a part-timer sometimes. The guy who maybe does it full-time, maybe he doesn't, but he's called to preach and he studies the English Bible and does the best he can. This has been, for the Baptist Church, and it was this period, both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength in a lot of local vitality. A weakness in you get a lot of stuff that's not too scriptural. You see, you get a man who's not well trained, who's too fervent, and these were good godly men, and led sacrificial lives. They can produce good, but it can also produce bad. So it wasn't, as I said, a blessing and a curse. The Methodist Church was the most vigorous. I've already told you why, because their organization was set up for it. Why? The circuit riding preacher. It was said that only crows and Methodist preachers could be found out in the rain. Got that? Out in the rain, crows only burn and fire out in the rain, and the Methodist preachers only men who would, no matter what, you know. And this was quite a scene, these Methodist preachers. They say this about, especially not just the Methodists, the men of the Methodists. Some Baptists ran circuits too, but the Methodists were, that's the way they did it. You understand, they go from one preaching opponent to the other, and if they had, if it was time to go, they went. If the weather was bad, they went anyway. Their horse went lame, they walked. These were heroic men. They didn't live very long. Most of them were single, and they burn out quick, and they die, got sick and died, if you were a Methodist preacher then, you were, you know, it's interesting, today a preacher's a preferred risk. You can get better insurance rates. but not then. These men didn't live very long. A lot of them did give up their lives. Not just Methodists, but there was some real heroism there. The few Catholics in the West were served by itinerant priests, except in the French settlements. The Catholic Church grew issued by immigration, not evangelism. Frontier worship was emotional, for the reasons I've given. Now listen, you understand, I'm not putting that down necessarily. It's like anything else. I would not give a nickel for a man's religion if it did not touch his emotions. There's nothing wrong with emotions. It's the emotionalism that's bad. And, listen to me, the fact that some people are more emotional in their worship than others does not give us grounds for ridiculing them. I'm not trying to ridicule them, I'm trying to understand them. All I'm saying is that less educated people, people live in an emotionally sterile world, tend to get their emotion where they can find it, and in their religion. Now, it can produce negatives, and it often does. But religion, I think in our churches, I think most of our churches would do well to give opportunity for the proper venting of proper emotion more than we do. Because I think our churches ought to be more emotional in the case than they are. But not give them to emotionalism. Often, listen, raising your voice and clapping your hands and shouting amen is not necessarily emotion. Often it's just noise. What I'm saying is, I think in our churches we need to laugh more and cry more. And there needs to be people, there needs to be some genuine expression of emotion. So, you understand what I'm saying? So it's like fire. It's like music. It's a powerful thing. It can easily be abused. So I'm not. But you understand what I'm saying? I'm saying there was good, there was bad. I'm just pointing out that frontier worship often was emotional. Yes?
Why do you think our churches are so much emotional?
Well, some aren't. Some aren't. Many.
But the vast majority are, quite emotional. Why do you think that's true?
Well, there are probably a number of reasons. I think people don't know. People are afraid. And people don't know how to properly. What happens is, because often the emotions get out of hand, it produces things which are an embarrassment to the church. People are afraid, and they don't know how to guide proper expression of emotion. I think that's the main reason. Sometimes it's a reaction against the charismatic. People get emotional, get charismatic. I think the opposite is true. I think the only way to get charismatic is to have a dead, dry service, and I promise you, they have a charismatic trouble. I'll give you more personal testimony where I preached for 13 years. We were known as the warmest church around of our churches. Very nice. We laughed a lot. We'd stop and go around a lot, you know, and cry. And we had a real good. And we're the only church that didn't have trouble with the charismatics. Only one that didn't have. Now, there are reasons for that. We had a strong eldership that wouldn't put up with it. But it never became a problem. But we had nice fellow ministers who kept, you thought they were going to keep the charismatics out, but you know, high liturgy, just keep it all cut and dry. The other ones had trouble. You know what I'm saying? I think because if you don't give people opportunity to vent their emotions in a legitimate way, often they'll come out in an illegitimate way. Now, there are many exceptions to that, but that,
that's just an opinion I have.
Based on very limited experience, but that's just my opinion.
And I have found this also, you must understand, don't you, not this, this is an important place to say this, that there is no necessary connection between emotion and spirituality. So the most spiritual people I've met have been not emotional at all. And some of the less spiritual, some of the least spiritual people I've ever met have been emotional and in worship. Understand, there's no connection. Sometimes people who are emotional, a person may be emotional and spiritual, or unemotional and spiritual, or emotional and unspiritual, or unemotional and spiritual. See, there's no connection, necessary connection. We must not equate enthusiasm with spirituality, or noise, or emotion.
I like what one of the elders, one of our elders said, used to say, he was a country boy, Kentucky, left Kentucky, and he said, I don't care how high you jump, your soul, when you come down, you walk with the Lord.
Because he'd seen too many people who would jump and shout around and be real spiritual church, you know, emotional.
And about as little intention of living a dynamic Christian life, you know, all week as you can possibly imagine.
So, we need to keep that in balance. Okay, let's get back to it. The frontier worship is often emotional, informal, lively, and filled with theological excesses. Now, for instance, they would often have a preacher. This was all kinds of churches. They'd have a preacher who would get up and preach the sermon. Then they would have the exhortation often by another preacher. They'd stop and have some psalms and a prayer. Then they'd have the exhortation in which the preacher would really go after you. Come down and get you. Talk to you like a dog. It really, a lot of stuff that we went on, we would never tolerate in our culture.
I mean, you get somebody who's
closest thing we have to it today is a preacher at the Grundy, Clarence Greenman. Ever hear Clarence preach? Kind of the old style. I was talking one time, he was attend a funeral that he preached. And he's preaching this funeral, and he'd have an invitation at a funeral. And it was one of his good friends, who was a Presbyterian, who was a backsliding Presbyterian in the community nearby in town. And he saw him back there, so he just took opportunity to talk to him, you know. Sure, wouldn't this be a good time for you to become a Christian? You know, when it's really going after you right there in the funeral service. And since that was normal for him, nobody thought I'd do that. That's what he did. I saw Don do well, because he was having a revival meeting with Clarence. He said, Don was telling me one time, we were out there in our car, calling. And this guy was walking down the street there, and Clarence was like, somebody else driving. He said, pull over here. And this guy said, come over here, and everybody called him Preacher Greenlee. Come over here. And I came over. Hello, Preacher Greenlee. And Clarence reached up behind by the lapels, real lovingly, and pulled him down into the car. And I said, Andy, just how long are you going to keep on going to hell? And he said, well, you know, I'm going to, one of these days, you know, he's in there, there's Andy standing there shopping with me, apologizing. You know, and just considered normal. Preachers do that today, probably get, you know, the word was spread, they get fired, but that's what I'm saying is that a lot of stuff that's pretty hard for us to imagine. But it produced, not always good, but it produced. This is on top of page 146, we're gonna start here on page 146 tomorrow, or Wednesday, the revival with Finney. General theological concepts of American Protestantism in this period. Number one, this is very important to understanding the American Restoration Movement, which we're coming to. Creeds as rigid tests of fellowship. They use creeds in a way back then, which we do not have any concept of today. Even the denominations do not use creeds today the way they used them back then. Do you realize that most Baptists don't even know anything about the Philadelphia Confession of Faith? Presbyterians would go to church year, week after week, and very little, if anything, be said of the Westminster Confession. But they were used back then, very stringently. There was a fixed distinction between clergy and laity. They believe in the level Bible. This is one that we're going to talk about, this restoration. And if they can find the plan of salvation anywhere in the Bible, they might find it in the Psalms, find it in the Gospels, find it in the Index, the Bible maps, anywhere between the covers of the Bible, they find the plan of salvation. Level Bible. There's no recognition of the difference between the Gospel and the law. Fourth, the doctrine of total depravity. One guy said about the doctrine of total depravity, somebody talked him out of it, he said that was the last time, he hated to give up that doctrine because he felt like total depravity was the only doctrine in the Bible he could really live up to. man was hopelessly lost and his will was bound. Conversion as an experience with extraordinary accompaniments. Conversion on the frontier churches, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, you name it, was, you weren't, how'd you know you were saved? What they call extraordinary accompaniments. Dreams, sights, sounds, visions, feelings, the direct voice of God. John, Franklin John Smith is going to tell about the time when a man said he knew he was saved. Why? Because the devil appeared to him and didn't kill him. What did the devil look like? Well, out in the woods, the devil showed up, the devil didn't get him, so he knew he was saved. What did the devil look like? Like a yearling calf. What was it? A yearling calf. man would be out working, the log would fall on him, scared to death, and that'd be his conversion experience. That's where voting came on. You heard about voting people into the church, man would get up and testify to his conversion experience. But it had to be spectacular. And have a vision, a dream, a near-death experience. And people would vote on it. They thought it was from God and that in the church.
If it wasn't, then you come back next week.
That's right. This was true both of Calvinists and Arminians. The general result of this was that emotional people got converted and people more given to logic and reason drifted off into skepticism. The American Restoration would pick them up. Interesting. The American Restoration was a great breath of fresh air when they said to the people, look, you want to be a Christian? All you have to do is want to. You repent and be baptized and you're a Christian. I mean, I don't have to have this experience, you know. And it came to be called rational evangelism. It was set against this thing with these of the gut-busting experiences. Last of all, Christian union. Thank God for the denominations. Everybody can go to the kind of church they like. Division was regarded as essential to the purity of the church. American religious liberty was exploited to the fullest.